the meeting to order and ask Celeste to call the roll, please.
Vilat?
Here.
D'Antino?
Here.
Erickson?
Here.
Evans?
Here.
Leidig?
Here.
Moffett?
Present.
Stevenson?
Here.
Stocking?
Here.
Rogers?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Well, we have a full house, full complement. That's nice. I want to first thank Jay for chairing the meeting in my absence last month. I appreciate that. And, I guess with that, we'll go to minutes of meeting number 1087, December 11th. Any additions or corrections?
Move to approve.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right. And we will go to our public hearing, City of Geneva Zoning Ordinance Text Amendments, Residential Area 1 Exemption. Request for text amendments to Section 11-5, Residential Districts of the Zoning Ordinance, which would exempt subdivisions containing more than 5 acres from the lot and area requirements established for properties located within Residential Area 1 and any other zoning ordinance text amendments related specifically to such exemptions that are deemed necessary and or desirable as determined by the Plan Commission or City Council. This is a public hearing which would require the reading of the procedures. I know Jay was very disappointed that it wasn't a public hearing last month, so he didn't get a chance to do that. If you'd like to do it tonight.
Mr. Chairman, actually, I was going to make a point of order. I guess we do have. I couldn't see to my left a second ago, so we do actually have somebody in the audience. So, yeah. So
maybe I'll do a.
If you want me, I can attempt.
Let's just do it.
Unless you got the recorder going, so I can play it in the future, right?
Let's just do a truncated version. I'll just point out that the procedure is that the Plan Commission will read or describe written items reports. I'm sorry, the Plan Commission Secretary will read or describe written items, reports, and plans into the record. Second, the petitioner, which in this case is the city, will present testimony in favor of the petition. Third, the commission will have an opportunity to question. Fourth, the commission will then receive citizen testimony, both for and against the petition. And finally, the petitioner may provide a rebuttal to any testimony in opposition. When all testimony is in the record, the hearing will be closed and the commission will make a recommendation to the City Council. In order to give testimony, you must provide your name and address on the registration sheet located at the entrance of the hearing room and sign in the space provided, and I believe I saw you doing that when I walked in, so that's been taken care of. By signing the registration sheet, you agree and understand that anything you say will be considered sworn testimony and affirm to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. We ask when you give testimony to approach the lectern, please be concise in your testimony, and if your point's been made, it's not necessary to repeat it. You may provide testimony in written form, but such written testimony must be presented to the Plan Commission Secretary or designated representative prior to the closing of the hearing. After the process is complete and everyone wishing to present testimony is spoken, the Commission will decide whether it has heard adequate testimony in order to make a decision. If it has, the public hearing will be closed. After the hearing is closed, the Commission will refrain from receiving any additional testimony, either for or against the petition. With one exception, city staff will submit a report based on testimony presented at the hearing. This report will consider comments or concerns from all city departments, such as fire, public works, and engineering. At this time, I will administer the oath to anyone who has signed the registration form and plans to present testimony. If you'd stand, please. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. And we will proceed. David, do you have any items to put into the record?
I do. In the Plan Commission file for this case, there's an application for a text amendment filed by the City of Geneva Community Development Department. There is a memo from the Community Development Department to other development staff within the city discussing the proposed text amendments. There's a memo to the Committee of the Whole requesting authorization for this Plan Commission hearing. There's a memo to Mayor Burns and the City Council summarizing the changes that were discussed at the November 24th Committee of the Whole meeting. There's the memorandum that was routed to the Plan Commission for tonight's meeting. For each of those memos, there were various photographs, maps, sketches, which illustrate the proposed text amendments and staff's additional research. And then finally, there's a certificate of publication for the Daily Herald for the legal notice for tonight's meeting.
Okay, thank you. And who will be presenting this evening?
I will be presenting.
Okay.
Okay. As I go through this, please feel free to stop me at any time with any questions or points of clarification. In 2003, the City Council adopted zoning ordinance text amendments that established tear-down or infill zoning regulations to achieve compatible development in the older, more mature neighborhoods in town. Those were refined later in 2005 and adopted in 2006. And since that time, have been working well. What they do is they essentially divide the city into two areas, Area 1 and Area 2. Properties located within Area 1 are subject to additional restrictions on lot coverage, setbacks, height, floor area, and garage locations. I personally haven't been administering these for very long, but my understanding is they've worked very well for kind of one lot infill construction. Recently, we've had applications for larger infill developments, subdivisions containing several new lots and a dedicated street. And in these situations, it's our opinion that these regulations, these tear-down infill regulations, may not be necessary, or because with a newly dedicated public street, you have an internal relationship for the houses within that subdivision, and they don't have the same kind of impact as the one lot on an already dedicated public street. I kind of try to illustrate that through streetscape photographs and aerial photographs that were attached in your packet. The streets in town I used were Stone Fence Lane, Southampton Court, Cape Way, Belter Court, Mead Court, and Creekside Drive. These are all located in various zoning districts. They each had a different length of the cul-de-sac, and the number of lots varied in each subdivision too. But as you can see, each one of these create kind of a rear yard relationship to the surrounding neighborhoods, meaning that the front yard of each property faces that newly dedicated public street. And for this reason, they don't have the same type of impact on the other properties in residential Area 1. Are there any questions on kind of staff's reasoning for feeling that situations are different from just a one-lot infill type of construction? No? Okay. So in order to kind of find out how we should go about exempting these newer subdivisions, we had to do some additional research. And looking at these six real-world examples, we looked at the lot size and the number of lots and the length of the street in each situation. And as you can see, the average size for these subdivisions was just over 5 acres at 5.21 acres. The average number of lots produced in each case was about 10 lots, and the average length of the cul-de-sac was about 450 feet. Taking that information, we thought it was also necessary to kind of sketch out and figure out what the most efficient subdivision could be. Using these exemptions, and the most efficient subdivision that could be created using the maximum cul-de-sac length, which is 500 feet, is illustrated in the table on page 2 of your staff report. And we did this for each subdivision or each zoning district that the teardown infill regulations apply to: the RE, R1, R2, R3, and R4 districts. And you can see there in that table that the average acreage required, again, is just over 5 acres at 5.5 acres. which is just slightly higher than the real-world examples that, that we used in town. We recognize that the number of lots in each one of these sketches could be reduced because we didn't accommodate for stormwater detention in our sketches. And we also recognize that exempt subdivisions might not always contain a cul-de-sac. They may contain a through street or a connection. And for that reason, as part of the exemption, we're proposing that corner lots, those lots that would have a relationship to the surrounding residential areas, not be exempt. Only the interior lots within the subdivision would be exempt. And that's illustrated by the map that was handed out in your packets and the one that's on the screen now. Using Creekside Drive as an example, all the properties that have that hatch mark in that new subdivision would be exempt from the Area 1 teardown infill regulations. But the two corner lots, because they have a street yard that either adjoins a street yard in Area 1 or is across the street from a street yard in Area 1, would not be exempt. So are there any questions so far on the proposal? Okay, I'm going to go into the actual amendments now. Sorry about that. To the zoning code, starting on page 3 of the report. The first actual amendment establishes the criteria that would exempt a property from the teardown infill regulations. The first one is that the real property is located within a subdivision approved, a new subdivision approved after a day to be determined, which consists of more than 5 acres, using the averages of the real world examples and the most efficient subdivisions we could sketch out. The second is that the street yard of the property is not located adjacent to or across the street from the street yard of a real property that is within residential Area 1. Just before the meeting here, and I mean just before the meeting, we kind of had a light bulb go off, that there could be a situation where you have a through street where these new lots could face inward towards the newly dedicated street, but the rear yard would still also be a street yard, which the way this is written, those properties would not be exempt. And the intention of the exemption was, when you have this interior relationship on those newly dedicated streets, the rear yard relationship to the surrounding properties is not really an issue. And even if that's a through street where the rear yard also backs up to a street, if there's property in residential Area 1 on the other side of the street, it may be facing that property, but you still have the right-of-way and you still have a rear yard of it of at least 35 feet by our zoning ordinance. So the impact would probably be equally, or the impact wouldn't be there just as much as it would as we've proposed. So Dick's kind of come up with some additional language that might clarify that.
I can kind of jump in here a little bit. As we were going through this, we've got some pretty, we have definitions of yards and lot lines in our zoning code that kind of interlace in pretty complicated way sometimes, and in reading through those definitions and reviewing them over and over again in relation to this proposed amendment, a street yard, there's no distinction made between a street yard involving a front lot line or a street yard on a through lot involving a rear lot line. So we would want to make clear in any amendment that would be advanced that in the instances where there is a street yard on a through lot, but it's essentially the rear yard of a house facing inward in a subdivision, that street yard at the edge of the development area that's abutting a street, and it's also adjacent to an area located within residential one, that in that instance, that exemption provision would not apply. So the language that we were discussing here before the meeting, if you look at B, under the residential area one exemptions, where it says the following zoning, in order to be exempt, the following provisions shall apply. The street yard or yards of the real property is not located adjacent to or across the street from the street yard of a real property that is located within residential area 1, where the teardown infill regulations apply. And then what we would propose to add is a sentence that simply reads, this provision shall not include street yards that are not adjoining designated front lot lines.
So if you used Creekside Drive as an example and it, say, projected up another 20 yards or so.
That tier of lots to the north?
And the lots to the north then touched on South Street, those would not be exempt. Those would be the same as the lots.
If their frontage was on the internal street.
Okay.
So we are proposing that one addition to that paragraph B in your memo. And again, the language reads, this provision shall not include street yards that are not adjoining designated front lot lines.
Are there any other questions on B?
I guess I'm kind of understanding that, but could you give me a better example? Let's talk about this one property on Western Avenue that if they put a cul-de-sac in there, the backyards facing Western Avenue, if in fact it were served off of a cul-de-sac, would not be exempt. Is that what you're saying?
In that situation, they would be exempt.
They would, even though across the street is front yards from somebody else. Right.
Now, if the front yard of those properties had access on Western Avenue, then they would not be exempt. So that's the distinction we're trying to make. If properties along Western Avenue had access off of Western Avenue, they would not be exempt because their front yard is directly across the street of properties in residential area 1.
The thinking being because of the setback?
The setback's much greater in a rear
they
yard.
They don't have the impact.
I guess I'm missing the distinction between Creekside Drive and what you just asked about. It seems like it's the same example. What's the difference?
You were adding land to Creekside, I think, and that's why I wasn't able to.
So I'm just saying if Creekside projected up so that the backyard was
all the way to South Street,
then they would not be exempt. But
right.
Dave just explained.
They would be exempt.
Sorry, they would be exempt.
They would be exempt.
If those along the northern side of Creekside Drive, if you're saying if the backyard went all the way to South Street, they would still be exempt, yes.
Okay, so they're different than the two entrance lots than those.
Yes. Right.
Okay. And then just, if I might jump in here, what you have in the zoning ordinance, particularly in our single-family attached districts, we have minimum setbacks for all the different yards, street, side, and rear. And the rear yard requirements in the districts typically fall in the range of 25, 30, or 35 feet. I think in our largest district, I think they're 40 feet for the rear yard. Our front yard setbacks range from 20 to 25 to 30 feet in most of those districts. But the effect of placing a house on a property typically results in a rear yard that is much greater than the minimum requirement set forth in the zoning ordinance. So you've got a situation with the rear yard relationship what's a good example? If you look at your packet, Filter Court, off of Western Avenue, there you can see you have lots that back onto Western Avenue that have access from Filter Court. And you can see in those houses the distance of the rear yard, the depth of the rear yard in relation to the depth of the front yards. Most of those front yards, I believe, are 25 or 30 feet. So you can see a substantial distance on each property in the rear yard. That rear yard is much deeper than the front yard. So when you combine that larger distance coupled with the street right-of-way, we feel that the principles of that we've been discussing with this commission of being more most vigilant in our teardown infill regulations to the relationship of the house to the street and the relationship from house to house to house along the street, along the frontage that the houses take access, the street frontage that the houses take access off of. That's the relationship that teardown infill regulations was designed to address. And that's the reason for this exemption.
Using, I know we haven't yet seen a formal plan for Mr. Augustine's plans for the Geneva Greenhouse property, but
yes.
I know that that's involved in this.
Yes.
I'm presuming that he's going to have a cul-de-sac street that runs perpendicular to Western Avenue and goes back and with houses on both sides. Even if he's not, let's just use that as an example.
Right now, it looks like he's attempting to advance through the staff review process a design that would have a loop street rather than a cul-de-sac street.
Okay. My concern is the two houses that would be at the corner of his new street and Western Avenue.
Yes.
If those houses face his new street, they are exempt. Is that correct?
Not if they're a corner lot where the street yard is still across the street.
Okay, so it's
if it's a corner lot.
If it's a corner lot, then it's not exempt, no matter which way the house faces.
That's correct.
Okay.
The house orientation really doesn't come into play. And honestly, we've tried to discuss this in terms of yards and lot lines because our zoning ordinance does not regulate which way houses face. We're really dealing with the effects of our zoning ordinance and how the subdivision is laid out. If the subdivision is laid out with an internal street, then the houses would naturally face inward, or most of them would, except for where the street comes to an intersection of a street outside of the subdivision, in which case those houses would be on the corner, and they would face either.
Yeah, so it's virtually inevitable that he's going to have two lots that are not exempt.
That's correct.
Okay.
Under this proposal.
Right.
Just as a point of clarification, Mr. Augustine's project was one of the projects that brought this situation to light, but it's not a text amendment initiated by Mr. Augustine. It's a staff-initiated text amendment, and it could apply to many other properties within the city. And I handed out a map. It should have been in front of your mics at the beginning of the meeting. It kind of just highlights areas where it might be possible. This is just an approximation. But it might be possible to see these kind of exempt subdivisions come into the city.
If I might add, we've had concept plan discussions on another subdivision off of South Street, where the same kind of provision might also apply that we're discussing here tonight. This same type of and what David has done here, obviously, this is all speculative here on our part. We're not out to go about the business of subdividing all of Geneva like this, but it's just to give you an indication of where some of the vulnerabilities may lie in terms of this kind of situation presenting itself.
Dick, when you call out vulnerabilities, are you saying that a single property owner is going to argue that point? Or is the city going to take the initiative and argue for the property owners? Because right now, the city is arguing for a single property owner who has an option on a piece of property. I think he has an option. I don't know if he completely owns it. And from what I see right now, it seems very convoluted, the thought process of how to come up with this. And so maybe you could expound on that.
Well, my only comment would be is that we're not doing this for one property owner. It has certainly come to light based on conversations and review.
But where's the benefit to any other property owner that we're talking about right now? There is none, except for future developers. All these properties that we see right now have very little benefit. When we look at some of these other examples, have very little benefit to those property owners.
It's really to the benefit of any property owner that would potentially be involved in subdivision of their land. Yeah, and I can't sit here and predict what those would be, but any city property owner that could assemble property or use their existing property in such a fashion as to meet the criteria that has been set forth in the proposal would potentially receive that benefit.
So you're telling me that property off of Batavia Avenue, between Batavia Avenue and the river, is going to be purchased by a developer combined, and then all those properties torn down for the single purpose of trying to be more dense in their development over there?
That's not what
I'm just saying, but that's what you're implying.
No, what we're implying is that some of these areas, because of the parcel sizes that exist, there's an opportunity to combine one or more properties within these designated areas, assemble the land, and develop a subdivision.
Can't we say that about the entire
city of Geneva?
Well, I suppose it comes down to looking at past history and looking at examples of where this kind of activity has either surfaced in the form of proposals or discussion with property owners that we've had.
Director Lynch, I guess to get to the meat of Mr. Commissioner Bielat's question, how many single-owner five-parcel properties currently exist? Out of everything you have mapped as potential, how many are single-owner 5 acres that would meet the requirements of what we're... I think that's... And again, I guess just to get a quick... It appears there's a significant amount of land assemblage that would need to take place by anybody else to make this work. And again, the city's the petitioner. I just want to end this part of the discussion.
I have not calculated what those are. I have determined the 5 acre parcels.
Would you speculate that it's not greater than one?
There are other parcels
that are greater than 5 acres of the identified parcels here without
so.
Assemblage?
I mean, I'm just estimating, but I believe
Okay, fair enough. Then.
But let me explain something. But I would also say to you that part of the discussion that drove the interest in proposing the amendment was based on discussions we had in a subdivision where parcel assemblage and separate parcels was contemplated. And we also have examples of subdivisions that have occurred over the past several years where assemblages were achieved to accomplish subdivisions. So the staff cannot anticipate where those subdivisions are those assemblages are going to occur, but I can tell you that we have experience on a staff level on people seeking to buy more than one parcel to subdivide, to create a subdivision.
And I'm aware of at least one parcel on South Street that for at least 15 to 17 years they've been talking about putting numerous property owners together, so I'm aware of that as well. And to basically defer to the staff side of this, Commissioner Bielat, it would prevent us from doing something we've specifically tried to avoid in the past in that spot zone. So if in fact three or four property owners got their 5 acres together and came here, we would, by amending the text now, we would avoid what we've always tried to avoid, spot zoning. So yeah. With that, you know, I'm trying to balance both sides.
No, I can understand what you're saying. When I look at this map and you talk about spot zoning.
I got a map as well. You know, the cost to assemble any one of these, we're talking millions of dollars of very viable real estate to assemble almost any one of these parcels at today's market to tear it down.
All we did was identify groups of parcels that we thought would have the potential either totally or in pieces that could be assembled to accomplish
Deborah, what happened, like, on
meadows, where there's a number of tear-down infill houses that went in individually. And let's say a developer who has developed a lot of those houses, let's say he assembled the lots in between, could he then, after the fact, set up a subdivision and fall into these guidelines after he's, he started piecemeal, but you could see, it seems to me that could happen very easily.
It could happen. It wouldn't happen in areas where individual infill house construction has already occurred, but if there were a cluster of what we've experienced here, if there was a cluster or a group of lots with houses located on those lots that, with the house and lot together, the value of the property was not enhanced by the house on the property, the value was the lot rather than the house and the lot, those are the situations where tear down infill construction is really attractive, has been attractive to those kinds of situations. So if you had some older homes that were not very high value properties, and there was a group of them, it's conceivable that there could be some reconfiguration there to accomplish a subdivision. But the ones in that area along Meadows and Dunstan, I wouldn't be as focused much on that area. We didn't identify it here because we've got zoning there that requires larger lot sizes. Some of the areas that we've often discussed internally on a staff level encompass the area there bordered by Meadows, Peck, Batavia, in that area where you can see some larger lots there. And we've really expected at some point that there'd be an effort to create subdivisions in that area just because of the large parcels.
Dick, I have a two-part question. One, would this allow a developer, if they could assemble a number of lots within a larger neighborhood, to create such a disruption to the fabric of that neighborhood that even though these houses were all internally facing and did not, and therefore were exempt, that just because he had put such a large block of them into this neighborhood that it really was not what we wanted to have happen?
I'm not sure how I could answer that, except that I do think that by design what we're proposing here is a regulation that really compels at least 5 acres, and given our zoning regulations, our bulk standards, it's going to require that 5 acres to be served by a street, at least one street. Those houses would be facing internal towards that street. And it's staff opinion that under that set of circumstances, compatibility would be achieved because of the distances of those houses from the surrounding houses. That's the principle.
Even if it breaks the fabric of a neighborhood by dropping this into the center of it, even if they don't face any of those other houses, I still think it could be quite disruptive to the whole fabric of that particular section of town.
It becomes a pretty subjective thing. I have not really think what we're doing here is trying to carry forward some principles that were incorporated into tear down infill regulations in the first place. That is that distance is important. That is the distance of the infill development from the surrounding neighborhood. And this set of regulations is really designed to use that principle, that same principle, in creating this exemption.
I think economics has a lot to do with just the challenge of doing an assemblage of what it's going to cost to try to put 5 acres together in an established neighborhood. It's going to make it prohibitive to do anywhere in town. I can't imagine where that could occur.
If
you look at this map, I can't see any place that really is viable for that, to get a new street. Seems very unlikely.
Would an alternative be to just have anybody use a PUD for this kind of, could that take care of it? Just, and then it would be on an individual case-by-case basis?
Well, we've looked at that alternative, and the zoning ordinance encompasses a whole body of regulations on planned unit development. And there are purposes and intent clauses within the PUD regulation that speak to what the how you use a PUD, how it should be used by the city. And if we're using planned unit development in a fashion to just go around the zoning regulations that would otherwise be applicable, that's really not what planned unit development is all about. Planned unit development should apply generally to somewhat larger parcels. There ought to be a clear design benefit of the proposed development that is achieved instead of following the rote standards of bulk regulation, where creative design and use of building orientation and building type and design elements of the building, the landscaping, the buffering, is done in such an arrangement that the conventional bulk standards aren't necessary, that you can look at it another way. It's more of a creative process of doing a planned unit development.
That seems to me to be exactly the kind of situations we're talking about here, where we would want to have that kind of leeway, that's what you're asking for, and where it would be beneficial to have the oversight that comes with the PUD process.
Well, in my opinion, the planned unit development regulations were not intended to be applied to subdivision, and what we're talking about here is subdivisions.
Dick, you are aware in the city of Chicago any development over 2 acres of land is a planned unit development.
I know, that's the way they do it in Chicago. But we have in my experience, we haven't done that in any planned unit development in town. Take on that kind of general approach. The idea is to utilize planned unit development to do creative design. And that it typically encompasses mixed use, multiple buildings on a zoning lot, and a totally different environment from that would be created with a conventional subdivision. If you're doing a conventional subdivision, then utilize the conventional zoning regulations. So that's why we would not advance the idea of doing PUD, just because it's an infill subdivision.
Has that been a past history, such as the old Sunset Pool? Was that done as a PUD? Because it, Dave, do you remember when we did that, Wyndencourt, where we built the townhomes and we had the day school separated off as a single-family home, and then we did the townhomes? Was it, because on the zoning map here, it's clearly shown as just white. It's shown as other zoning. So I've got to assume that was done as a PUD, and it's not a five-acre parcel.
The townhomes were done as a PUD.
Yeah, and it's far from a five-acre parcel. It's more in line with 2.5, if that. So are we breaking stride from past practices in the city now?
It's not single-family residential either.
It's not single-family.
It's mixed use.
Multifamily, yeah.
Okay. Well, no, there's a single-family home on the parcel. The house on the corner, the old...
Okay. The way I'm looking at the map, the house on the corner, I could be mistaken, but it appears to be yellow, so it seems to be subdivided off.
Oh.
And that's why I use that parcel in particular.
Yeah, I don't think it... Well, yeah, it probably was subdivided off. At one point, it was all...
Right, it was the single park district had it off.
Right.
Yeah, and that's... Okay, I was just trying to draw a parallel. Director Unch, the issue of the fabric of the neighborhood, I think, is a very strong, compelling issue. In the next paragraph... Mr. DeGroote was about to talk about C. The real property complies with the lot and area requirements established for real properties located within residential area 2, which to me says that we're decreasing the lot and area requirements that are standard for Area 1, which is thereby tearing from the fabric of the neighborhood, especially if we're allowing zoning classifications of R3 and R4. And with that, I would have to say, is there any way we can make sure that we don't tear apart the fabric of the neighborhood by raising the issue? The new zoning classification can be no denser than the least densely zoned bordering property. So to avoid somebody coming up and saying, this allows me to go R4, so you know, based on past practices, every single person that ever wants to do this is going to ask for R4 zoning, if in fact they assemble property. And they're going to say, due to the economic reality of the cost of property assemblage, I need R4 zoning. I need 6,500 square foot lots as opposed to the neighboring 15,000 square foot lots. Is there some way we can protect the fabric of the neighborhood as we look at this?
I guess my only comment would be is that in the example you're citing, the fabric of the neighborhood is really unchanged in terms of underlying zoning. The underlying zoning would stay the same. The only way that underlying zoning would change is if a petition were advanced and this commission conducted a hearing to change the zoning. The underlying zoning would not change unless you considered a change.
I guess when I look at the drawn-out examples, I don't know where there's achieved benefit for assemblage of parcels on some of these drawn-out examples, because I'm not seeing how they increase the number of lots in numerous cases.
It wouldn't increase the number of lots. The way it's set up is if you have R3 zoning, within R3 zoning district, you have Area 1 and Area 2. Area 1 is more restrictive in terms of lot coverage, building heights, setbacks, locations of the garages, etc. This exemption would take it out of Area 1, and the underlying zoning is still R3, and just the residential Area 2 regulations would apply, which allows slightly larger floor areas, lot coverages, and standard setbacks instead of average setbacks.
If you were to change this and exempt all these properties potentially, I'm just wondering, is the outcome that we would like to see to encourage this kind of assemblage? Because I see this only as encouraging it.
I think it's what this amendment, this proposed amendment, is trying to do. It's trying to focus the attention of the teardown infill regulations on what we discussed for 5 years, and that was the control of mass scale and location of individual buildings in relation to individual buildings along dedicated streets in relation to the houses on either side, across the street, and in the area surrounding that house. So what we're trying to do is separate that individual infill house and how it's regulated. Okay, consider that. That's one thing. We're trying to look at subdivisions in the broader context where there isn't a specific relationship of a lot and a house on either side of that lot, in the back and the front. It's not dealing with that individualized, individual lot relationship. We're looking at the prospect of a potential subdivision of a larger area and the impact of that individual subdivision. And what we're saying is that the perimeter distance between the buildings in that proposed subdivision, houses, and the houses around that subdivision, is large enough to insulate the effects of
So you could have greater lot coverage and height, building height, and all that sort of thing. And what I'm saying is, do we want to encourage that to happen on these potential parcels, or do we not want to encourage that to happen? Because if you change it, you are encouraging it to happen. It is that something we want to do?
It's probably a fair question. It comes back to, you know, where do your principles lie? What are we out to achieve? If we're looking at compatibility of individual infill houses proposed and pop up within mature neighborhoods, that's one objective. If we're looking to, and when I say we, the collective we, if we're looking to create subdivisions that are also the houses, individual houses within that subdivision are also smaller as a group, then we can basically keep what we have intact. But I believe that through the conversations that we've had over these years, that the real objective of the tiered infill regulations was to deal with that individual lot in its relationship to the houses immediately abutting and adjacent to it, not this larger subdivision.
I would argue that it also was neighborhood preservation and preserving the character of the community as a whole, that it went beyond the relationship between two adjacent lots.
Oh, it definitely went to the surrounding neighborhood. But I'm just saying that there is, it's a different objective if you're saying you're going to regulate the mass, scale, and size of multiple houses within the subdivision, as opposed to an individual lot in its relationship to its surroundings.
I guess I have a question of the commission and whether they have any concerns about what the impact of this teardown infill has had on the community. Because I've done some research, and I'll pass this out to each one of you. Just on my little local area, and I had argued one little issue associated. Maybe you could take one and pass this down. I had spoken about an issue when we were talking about teardown infill, and it had to do with the impact of the communities of which this R1 and these restrictions were being placed. What I've passed out is a map of just my immediate area, and this isn't scientific, but I've got a few extra copies if you need it. And this is the immediate area actually where I live, and this is not a scientific project that was done because I really didn't have any funds to support it. What you see here are rental properties in my community, and some of that is due to having small homes on smaller lots and with people not able to do much with their properties. And this was something that I brought up when we were talking about this 5 years ago. And if this is the goal of the city, is to have unoccupied owner properties who don't necessarily keep their properties up, this is what is somewhat of a result of what we were talking about with regards to tear down infill. These homeowners, we've got a school in this community here whose enrollment is dropping drastically. First off, they closed it for an entire year to make renovations to it. You don't have families moving into this area. You have fewer and fewer kids who are going to be able to be going to this school. And we as a city are going to end up busing people to this school in order to kind of make it work, and that's Harrison Street School. All of these things are coming about, in my opinion, as a result of some of the restrictions that have been put on tear-down infill. And remember, we made some of these decisions at the height of the economic times. And now staff is arguing because now we're at the bottom of economic times and we want to try and make a development work for a developer who has petitioned. The problem that we've got at this point is that John Q. Public, single homeowner, doesn't have the opportunity to come to staff and argue for their point. It takes a developer who has millions of dollars at risk to come to staff and try to argue a point. Because I think we all know, I would imagine the majority of commissioners understand the economics that are at risk on that development for the greenhouse development. Maybe, Dick, you could speak to what your opinion is of the impact of this many rentals in a community.
Well, I understand your concern, and I...
Are you concerned as a planner?
I'm concerned about quality of life and the residential communities in every aspect.
Where you live. Where you live.
But honestly, I fail to see how this relates to what we're proposing.
When staff brings up an issue regarding tear-down infill, I think it's an opportunity for everybody to even take a look at what has been done up to this point. And it does point towards how staff addresses whether it's a single issue or if it's a developer coming to the table asking certain questions.
All I can tell you is that... And we could get into a lot of conversation about this, and I would be more than happy to dialogue with you and anyone else on the commission that wants to get into discussion about what's happening with owner and renter-occupied housing in any part of the city. I think it's a pretty complex question. I think it's difficult to focus on any one causal factor in what's going on, because I think it's laden with multiple factors affecting it. When it comes to maintenance of property, I understand your point.
And we've had discussions with our aldermen, and there really isn't any rules associated with what the city could do to help these people maintain those.
The point I wanted to make was that we do not make a distinction between our code enforcement activities and whether the property is an owner or renter-occupied property. Certainly, we have encountered instances on both sides with both owners that have been difficult to deal with in terms of bringing about proper property code compliance, and we've seen it with renters as well. So there's no question that there are challenges. A lot of the renter-occupied housing that we see in town is tied directly to the original subdivision, the smaller size lots, the more modest houses that were built on those lots.
But what you've done with the tear-down infill is, even on those properties, you've tied the hands of those property owners. And again, we've argued in many instances in this room about increasing density close to the city center. We've done it on many instances, and we've approved a lot of projects in that regard. But what we're talking about is on these properties, and you're right, these are small lots and they're small homes. But what you're doing is now you're not allowing for maybe a benefit to be achieved by living closer to the city, to the inner city. And, you know, Joel could speak to the vacancies that are taking place in the downtown area. I just think we should, as planners, as thinkers, as looking out at the future, we need to look at data. We need to look at information like this and try to get beyond it and try to stop it and look for solutions, as opposed to always being reactive in things in that regard.
I lived on my block for over 30 years. For the first time in all that time, we now have 3 rental properties on our block. It has absolutely nothing to do with tear-down infill. In fact, one of them is a house that a speculator bought in intending to tear it down and build a new house and got caught in the economic slump and decided to rent it. The other two are homes that were on the market for several months and couldn't be sold, and they ended up renting them. I don't think you can, by any stretch of the imagination, say that tear-down infill caused those rental properties. Am I happy about more rental properties on my block? No. But I'm not blaming anyone in particular for it, because I certainly don't think tear-down infill had anything to do with it. I'd be just as happy if that speculator could tear down the house and build a new house, and he was perfectly willing to do that within the current regulations. So, I think we're stretching a bit to identify every rental property as the fault of tear-down infill.
I don't think, I really wanted to get back to number C, but I don't think that's Commissioner Bielot's whole point here. I think Commissioner Bielot's point is we were over restrictive to so many property owners that prohibited them under our past regulations from improving their property, if I'm not mistaken. I think that's his whole point, that the regulations we put in place were overly prohibitive on the smaller lot size properties because it did not allow them the opportunity to put a second story on or to put any addition on to create a more viable living space for that size lot. I think, am I wrong?
No, I agree. And it's not just it. And part of the challenge that we have with the teardown infills is that it also includes additions to homes also. So I'll tell you, in my specific neighborhood, there's a lot of small homes, okay? There's a lot of ranch homes. A lot of, some people back when I first moved there, they built additions on their homes. A lot of them probably can't do that now with regards to that. And what has happened is that there aren't any kids in the neighborhood anymore. And again, you have a community school, and there aren't any kids any longer. And it's really it's shifted to a lot of whether it's single parent home. I mean, because people don't live the way they used to in the 50s, and that's what we have over here: 1940s and 1950s little small ranch homes.
My previous house was a small ranch home over on Valley, very small. The whole neighborhood was teeming with children. It still is. But from living there, the time that I was there, which was approximately 8 years, several of the houses sold in my area, and they became renters, and there's been absolutely no code enforcement. We have several families in each house. I mean, it got so bad that my husband got fed up, sold our house in a day and a half, which I was kind of shocked at with this way the economy is. Then we moved over to the furthest possible northeast corner of Geneva, over by Chandler, over on Hunter Court, where right next where Don Vogelsberg used to live. And over there, we are teeming with children all over the place, and there are a few rentals behind us. And there are still, I see tons of kids who are going to Harrison, and the renters just don't seem to take care of their property as well as the owners do. So that has just been my view. So then my next question is, maybe what we have is a rental problem, and we need more code enforcement.
Well, we're straying far away from the subject of this public hearing at this point.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask something of Planner DeGroot here?
Yes.
He mentioned the answer to my fabric of the neighborhood by not change, allowing for a reclassification of the zoning. His answer was the underlying zoning does not change. Now, what about, I have no idea what any of these other properties are zoned since we don't have an overlay of the zoning map here. But what about, say, the Burgess Norton all of a sudden, which clearly would be bounded by residential neighborhood one, if they decided to redevelop that property, they would have open, because the zoning now is currently other than residential, it's white, would they be able to come in and say, we want any zoning we want, obviously, correct?
They would have to petition to rezone the property and to designate a residential Area 1 or Area 2.
Mm-hmm. So that, and you're saying that because some of these large parcels that can be assembled are zoned in the current zoning classification, there would be absolutely no ability for any petitioner to request reclassification. That's our protection mechanism? Is that... I don't see what would prohibit them from coming in and saying, now that I've got this, I need reclassification of the zoning. That's my big concern, to protect the fabric of the neighborhood.
They can't. There's nothing to prohibit them from requesting rezoning, no. But that is something that would be considered by staff and by the Plan Commission, whether or not that zoning is appropriate for that neighborhood, for that compatible with the surrounding properties. In terms of lot sizes and setbacks of that district that they're requesting.
We're already, you know, and I love Mim's comment calling it fabric of neighborhood by allowing Area 2 bulk regulations in Area 1. We're already compromising the fabric of the Area 1 residential neighborhood, even though we're saying that it's a self-contained neighborhood, but it borders, even though we're talking about backyards. You know, but I think Director Unch indicated that in some cases, rear yard setbacks are only 20 feet.
Well, we're talking about requirements as opposed to practically what's built.
But we also know that past practice pretty much has dictated that in mass, in bulk situations, we're seeing them built to the maximum extent of the envelope. The past historical practice for, I want to say, almost 20 years has been built to the extreme capacity of the lot based on that, and which, again, is the exact point that Commissioner Evans is making, the fabric of the neighborhood issue, and that's what bothers me when I look at C. That's the underlying problem that I have with C.
Well, aren't you also going to try to promote cul-de-sacs? I mean, doesn't this kind of promote that? And is that really what we want? Is there a benefit from a design standpoint to put in a cul-de-sac under this text amendment?
I think any infill subdivision, whether you're talking about this amendment or without the amendment, an infill subdivision, we've got a number of them where a cul-de-sac has been built, just because the street stubs haven't been provided off of abutting properties, and so the property owner assembles the land to create the subdivision, and the only way that he can really do it is by putting in a cul-de-sac. But as a general rule, the development staff kind of takes the point of view of when we're discussing, you know, concept plans with prospective applicants, this community and this staff, I should say, is really averse to creating any new cul-de-sacs.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's a function of particular geometry of the parcels that would be encompassed within a new subdivision and what street stubs might be available off of abutting areas to the site. If I could try to just refocus things a little bit here.
Please.
This proposal is really intended to address one tear down infill regulations that have been in place now for 5 or 6 years. It's primarily focused attention on individual infill houses and their relationship to the surrounding neighborhood, trying to achieve compatibility. Do you want those same provisions to apply to subdivisions within the area where tear down infill regulations apply or not? It's really that simple. Do the same principles that apply to that individual tear down infill house, do you want those to apply to a group of new houses that would be built in the city, in a new subdivision, in a shorter part of the city? That's the question. We believe the distinction on staff level, we believe the distinction can be made between the advanced
David, is there anything else you wanted to present?
Just to go a little further on Dick's point there, I just want to clarify again that if you're in residential area 1, the regulations that apply are for lot coverage, floor area, average setbacks. The lot size, the lot frontages do not change. So it doesn't allow for more lots. This exemption does not allow for more lots. It just allows for slightly larger lot coverage, floor area, maybe building height. And then that's what was intended by number C there in Amendment 1.
Right. I understood
just
that.
Just to say that regulations do apply. You're not exempt from all regulations, just to make sure that that was clear. Amendment number 2 just kind of cross-references Amendment number 1 in each zoning district that the tear-down infill regs apply, just so if they're going to their zoning district, they see that right away. That would be at the front of the lot and area requirements, that there is an exemption. Do I qualify? They can cross-reference this section. And then Amendment 3 is to change the residential area map, which should be attached at the end of your packet. Residential areas 1 and 2 are not changing on this map. The map that's in the zoning ordinance now is not very legible at an 8.5 by 11, so we just wanted to make it a little clearer and to have a better description of residential area 1 and 2 in the legend. And then the legend again does cross-reference this exemption section. So outside of that, I mean, that is staff's report. Our recommendation are the amendments as shown on pages 3 and 4. If the commission needs time to digest this information, we can close the public hearing, but make the recommendation at the next planning commission meeting.
Any other questions?
I guess I still want to. Are lot regulations for R4 are the same regardless if it's in Area 1 or Area 2, so we're not going to have any change in side yard setbacks, rear yard setbacks, anything like that as a result of this?
Correct.
Okay, so if the underlying, so the only thing we're allowing is the change in, if you would, the lot coverage ratio area. And that's
right. The only setback that varies with residential area 1 or 2 is the front yard setback. In area 1, it's the average setback of the surrounding houses.
Okay.
But yes, the only things that would change are lot coverage, height, floor area, and garage locations. That's what residential area 1 addresses or further restricts within the zoning district.
So in theory, the whole argument is that when this is a backyard-only subdivision to neighboring properties, everything from a streetscape can have the greater bulk and mass that would be associated with the properties found in Area 2, but it's self-contained in theory because of the streetscape.
Correct.
And as long as we had the underlying, as long as there's not a change in the density aspect, but that could be a petitioner requested situation.
No change in density.
No, unless, of course, the petitioner requested the change.
Be a separate request.
And city council.
So did I kind of hit it on a nutshell what this is doing then?
I think you did.
I don't disagree.
Yeah.
I think that sums it up. Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to straighten my own mind that they're not getting a change in zoning, because that's what bothered. I didn't understand that aspect, so I'm clear on that. Thank you.
Anyone else?
This may be off track here, but I'm just trying to understand what's the tax implication and the property value implication for surrounding properties by doing this. You know, when we put the tax info things in place, was before my time, but how did that affect the taxing entities and assessments? How would this affect it?
I'm not sure that I have an answer for you.
Who determines that, Dick? I mean, is it
township assessor assesses?
The assessor does.
Yeah.
Do we make a recommendation? Do we say anything about the taxing, the effect of this? So, like where I live, you know, there's three or four different kinds of taxes in the same area. Depends on what kind of a lot you're on. You're on a main street.
The tax assessor is going to use whatever criteria he chooses to use to value your property. And I know they have formulas, and they go through an arithmetic exercise to determine the assessed value of your property.
So your assessor might be looking to assess this as a separate area and not affect the surrounding properties by virtue of its creation.
I would be really careful to draw any connection between this action and assessment of property. I just don't have the expertise to do it. I mean, the basic corollary that tends to hold true: the bigger house on a bigger lot is assessed more than a small house on a small lot. But there are 1,000 ways of slicing that, and you've got to go through an arithmetic exercise to and use the criteria that the assessor uses to develop what the assessed value is of the property.
Ron, I might be able to help you. Even though I'm retired from that industry, I worked in it for a great number of years, and Joel probably has some inside information on this as well. But typically, the assessor based the assessed valuation on residential property on what the purchase price is. Now, on an infill teardown, when you do a rehab, and that might mean you leave the corner where the utilities come into the property, you typically get a four-year exemption on any increase in the real estate taxes. So, say somebody put a house that looks like about a $4 million house on Hawthorne Lane on a house that used to be a $600,000 house, and you look at his tax bill right now and you say, geez, the guy pays less than me. Well, that's because he has an exemption on taxes. Eventually, because he gets taxed for improving the property, he gets a break for, I think the law currently is, it's a state statute, I think it's currently 4 years. But on a brand new property, the assessor only has the purchase price to go on. So if it's a totally, you know, wipe the slate clean, if somebody were to assemble all the property between Peck Meadows, Batavia Avenue, and the other, Fargo, I guess that is, and wipe out all those $1 million worth of homes, and then only build $150,000 homes on that and sell $1,050,000 homes and take the personal hit, yeah, we'd lose a heck of a lot of assessed valuation. I don't think an investor's willing to do that. So the assessor really looks at sales price. We do have an anomaly on the infill properties if they're not torn down, and many of the shrewd developers leave literally a piece of concrete where the utility came into the property, and everything else is brand new, but that one piece is left for assessed purposes. If that helps you understanding why, if you think some of these infills should be paying more in taxes and they're not, if you're doing that research.
No, I was just wondering what the effect is on the existing taxpayers, the adjacent properties of this. So it's really up to the assessor.
Anyone else? This is a public hearing, ma'am. Did you wish to address this issue? Okay.
It's a scary thought.
motion then to close the public hearing.
Second.
Moved and seconded to close the hearing. Celeste, call the roll, please.
Bielak?
Aye.
Antino?
Aye.
Erickson?
Aye.
Evans?
Aye.
Leidig?
Aye.
Moffitt?
Aye.
Stevenson?
Aye.
Stocking?
Aye.
Rogers?
Aye.
Okay, the hearing is closed. Next question is, David brought it up. Do we want to hold this over and consider it and address the vote at another meeting, or do we want to take a vote this evening?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
We often decide to take a vote that evening because it's there's a time element that we want to try to cooperate with the developer or whatever. In this instance, is there any need to move this along?
Mr. Chairman, I'd have to ask the question, is there any reason that we wouldn't take a straw vote to find out if people are ready to vote on this evening rather than have a meeting just to come in and slap the gavel? And, you know, I, for one, struggle with the issue, but I think I have some clarity on it based on staff's comments tonight, and I could make a vote on it tonight.
Why don't we just have a show of hands who would like to vote on it tonight, or could or would vote on it tonight? It's like a pretty clear majority.
Mr. Chairman, then I'd like to make a motion to waive the bifurcated process and vote on this tonight.
Second it.
Second it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. We always look to you, Jay.
Let's see. I got to find the exactly where it covers everything. I think we got to go back to Dave. Where did you read the original stuff off?
Right off the agenda.
The agenda. Okay. Then let's refer to the agenda. Then Celeste, for your ease, I'm going to read the agenda if you want to copy it later. The city of Geneva, I hereby move to approve a request by the city of Geneva for a zoning text amendment for residential area 1 exemptions. Request for text amendment to section 11-5 residential districts of the zoning ordinance, which would exempt subdivisions containing more than 5 acres from the lot and area requirements established for properties located within residential area 1 and any other zoning ordinance text amendments related specifically to such exemptions that are deemed necessary and or desirable as determined by the Plan Commission or City Council. Now, for a question of formality, should I add any of the other actual amendment information? Because I see we talk about 11.5 here. In other places, we have 12-1, we have 11-2 for...
I think if you just wanted to say, like, as presented in staff report, in staff's planning commission report.
Okay, so we will add that.
As amended.
Yeah, as in adding all the staff actual amendments as listed in the staff report.
Celeste will make that make sense, won't you?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Do I need anything else, Dick, or Dave?
Did you want staff's suggestion of that one sentence to be included, the one provision that's...
As far as I was concerned, it was presented that way to me, not written, so absolutely.
Well, that would be the amendment.
That would be the amendment.
Right.
Okay,
right.
There you go.
That's
gotcha.
Presented.
It was in amendment number one, right?
Amendment 1B.
Okay.
All right, there's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. Celeste, will you call the roll, please?
Okay. Bielak?
Nay.
Antino?
Nay.
Erickson?
Aye.
Evans?
Nay.
Leidig?
Aye.
Moffitt?
Aye.
Stevenson?
Aye.
Stocking?
Nay.
And Rogers?
Aye.
Motion carries 5-4.
Oh. All right. Council will have to take a close look at that one. else come before us?
I have some other updates I could give you.
Okay.
The last plan commission meeting was a conceptual site plan review from 106 North Bennett. Per the plan commission's recommendation, he is working to relocate the building to utilize the riverfront. More than having it pushed up against the street there, but he is still proposing a 6,000 square foot multi-tenant building for office and retail. He's required to submit plans by February 9th, which would put him on the April Plan Commission public hearing. So we have that one coming up in a few months, I guess. The Delnor Hospital is looking to put in an imaging center on the southwest corner of Williamsburg and Delnor Drive. We've met with them to go over conceptual plans. They have a few other roadway improvements within the PUD that they need to do before we will consider future projects, but they are also aiming to make that February 9th deadline to go forward in April. We don't have anything else that will be coming before the Plan Commission right now for the February public hearing, but we do have some text amendments we're working on that we're hoping to move forward quickly, at least by March. And then I just have a question with your packets. Is there anyone here who didn't pick them up at the police station this time?
Who didn't?
Did not. Okay. Because the last time I forgot to take that poll, so your folders were over there. And then if you did pick them up, if you could just return your folders before you leave tonight, I'd appreciate it.
Chairman, I've got a question. Can we get an update on a couple projects, whether it's the Jane DeShanti project, the South Bennett project that seems to be weathering really poorly? I mean, there's been several projects that have been approved, and they just really are eyesores to the community, and just want to get some feedback on that if possible.
Sure. On the Enclaves project, the holdup over these many months, and I want to say now it's reaching the better part of the year, that we have been observing a dispute between two of the property owners within the East Gateway PUD that have not been able to reach agreement on the cost sharing for the new intersection of Oakkirk Road and Route 38.
You don't think not selling any condos has anything to do with it?
Emergency.
But it has just reached a point where we continue to hear that they're almost in agreement, or the paperwork is on somebody's desk and they're about to sign it.
And we've heard that so many times that it's almost, hate to say it, but it's almost laughable.
So we're at a point where as soon as they reach agreement, because they're bound by the planning and development and PUD ordinance and the annexation agreement to agree, and once they agree, we can proceed with the formal creation of the SSA and the corresponding development agreement, and can proceed with the construction of the road.
Did the city council pull the $3.5 million bonding that they were going to do for this project?
No, it's all on hold because they have not
come to terms with how they're going to pay it off, basically.
So we never, as taxpayers in the city, we never formed
no,
that
no, 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 no,
good.
No, no.
And all the agreements are drafted in place and ready to be executed. The enclave's property owner, and then you have the owner immediately to the west. And
who is that to the west? Is that?
It's the entity, I believe, is I don't know if it's an LLC, but it's LFI Location Finders Incorporated.
Oh, okay.
Owns that property, and they feel that By shifting the new intersection further east, away from their property,
that they have lost value because the proximity of that new intersection that would be built to their property is just not, it's not as close. And so it gets back into the economics of a potential development of the site and whether they have sufficient resources out of that development to pay towards the improvements. I got to believe that if we were in a better market condition, that somehow the dollars would surface, or the dispute over the proportion of share would be less of an issue, you know, and we'd move on. But just given our situation, we're all in here. You know, it's just sitting there. And we have had discussions about the unstable condition of that site.
Yeah, that's my concern.
And it's you know, it's obviously going on and on and on. If we don't have action this spring, then we'll have to institute action against that builder to stabilize the site. That has to happen because it can't be left like that another season. But anyway, that's where that stands. I wish I had a more positive report, but it's been a very painful process. The other one you mentioned, South Bend, which one?
And that was the small residential subdivision.
Oaks of Mill Race?
Yes.
That subdivision reached a point where we were out of committee of the whole with a recommendation of approval, having gone through... You went through your review, went through all of the detailed review work on a staff level, and that was ready to be forwarded to City Council for final action. And the city, as a part of its review of the engineering plans, through further analysis of the water system in the area, determined that an additional water main improvement would be required to service the property properly. And once the development entity found out what the cost, their engineer that developed the cost estimate on the water main extension, and there was a discussion about a cost share for that improvement with the city, which the city took a position. I don't have the exact figures in mind. But the resulting obligation on the part of the property owner for that improvement, we're told, created a problem for that subdivision to move forward. So that one literally...
Did he purchase that property, or...?
I believe it is.
Shows for sale.
Yeah. Purchased the property.
So, for that property, and it's gone through... our committees and is sitting, you might say, at the committee of the whole. Could a new property owner just introduce it to the city council now that it's gone through this process?
Oh, using that
using what has been approved up to this point, I guess is a question.
Without coming back to us.
Correct. Yeah.
There is a time clock on the Plan Commission action on the zoning and subdivision plat. But once you've recommended out, there isn't a time clock by code that runs on the committee of the whole action. Practically speaking, I'm just going to venture to say here that I doubt that someone would just come along and like buy that set of plans and advance it at this point. That's just my sense of it. But we have basically had no contact of any kind with that development entity.
Do you recall what the cost is going to be on that water main?
We have it. I don't have it off the top of my head. It's a little bit.
That property is very problematic at this point, isn't it? I mean, it's hard to imagine anyone in the foreseeable future coming in and being able to do anything economically viable with that property.
Well, I mean, the big issue is the house that's on the property.
Yeah,
it's definitely a
beautiful property.
Kind of subdivision property, and it can be done. We've got a design that demonstrates that it can be done.
a lot depends on how many homes get built, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if it's two homes, then it's
you don't need to water.
You don't, exactly.
Well, that's true.
I think it's more complicated.
And that's where,
because there's an efficiency, a pretty fundamental deficiency with the water main that's been present, because they were just going to tap into that water main, and the engineers looked at it and said, whoa. And it has to do with, I think it's even a substandard diameter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you blow it up.
They talked about that as part of the whole thing. The question I have, because the property walked through it, and that's a year ago, and if that was wide open and he had some rodent infestation at that point in time, from a building code standpoint, that thing almost should have been, okay, fire department, you practice in here and you burn this thing down.
They have practiced on the home.
They have practiced, but they didn't use it as a burn building.
Yeah.
But I think the code enforcement aspects for, you know, because the gate's open, anybody can drive.
The fence was knocked down for a period of time.
Yeah, the fence was down.
It's been a while since I've been down there personally. I know we have a security issue in the board up the building, so it's been boarded up.
That's the problem.
I'll make a point of having him look at it just to see what he's seen out there. Just to check on
The fence isn't falling down anymore, but there are gaps in
there. There's a 2x4 holing up a big section of it, sticking into the right of way of the street right away.
A lot of other projects, but they built, they're escaping a lot of the other ones. The second building at Fisher and Williamsburg.
No action.
Okay. Because it seems like they did a pretty nice job getting a fair amount of occupancy, a higher level of occupancy than I expected in that.
She did.
How about the second building on Williamsburg west of Randall?
No permits to be filed
over there. Because we see nothing of that. That both of these are now just permits, right?
Correct.
Okay.
The project on Brewster Road behind Fresh Market has totally gone away.
Surprise.
I mean, really, when you look at development conditions generally, just about every development, whether it's a prospective development or a development that was in the system and advancing forward, has either slowed or stopped. Virtually everyone.
Dick, what's going on with the old barbecue restaurant there on East State?
The Ribbon House.
Yeah, the Ribbon House.
It looks pretty now.
What's going on? Yeah, I took the trees out.
David, you want to get into this? David's been working
with Well, there's a new owner, and he's looking, what was it, a Greek restaurant he wanted to put in there?
Mediterranean
restaurant. But he wants to put an addition off the back of the property as well. And because he's putting the addition on, that would require additional parking to be provided. And the site now only has like 7 or 8 spaces at best, which wouldn't sustain a restaurant anyhow. So he's looking into purchasing the property next door, the Me and Dad's Toys property, and combining them into one zoning lot to accommodate for additional parking. And
we tear down Me and Dad's Toys.
Right. And if he got that property, I kind of sketched it out, and it looks like he should be able to provide enough parking and meet all our setback requirements. So I hope that goes through for him.
Who bought it? Is it somebody local?
Nick Nicolau is his name. I don't know anything else about him, really.
Sure looks nice, though.
Will do.
Anything else? Any other questions?
One thing I would just final point to make is that on a staff level, we were all geared up to start the downtown master planning process. And unfortunately, just with what's happened with revenue generation this fiscal year, it's given cause to really just put a hold on things until we understand better what the performance will be overall for this fiscal year. And so we didn't want to get ahead of ourselves starting a project and just being
and it's stuck in a bad situation in terms of paying for it. That remains a very high priority for the City Council. The strategic plan calls out numerous objectives
that are to be addressed through that planning process. We will be prioritizing at staff level, we'll be prioritizing projects, both capital and special projects. We call this a special project. For including the budget for the next fiscal year, so much depends on just where things stand for sales tax revenue. It's not our only revenue source, but it's a big revenue source. And we really utilize retail sales tax revenue to support most of the substantive capital improvement projects that are not MFT, motor fuel tax related, or special projects like this. A final point, just to give you an order of magnitude of what we're talking about here. In round numbers, we've been generating around $5 million a year in retail sales tax revenue, and we project that out for budget purposes. So for this fiscal year, our finance department is projecting us to be a little over 11% off of projection. So that puts you into a shortfall of $500,000 to $600,000, and that's what's impacting some capital projects and special projects out there. So as we learn more about performance of the various revenue sources, we'll be making decisions over the next couple of months and advancing a budget to the council. But I do feel that we've got some challenges ahead of us here. We're going to be looking at trying to do things creatively and minimizing costs, like everyone's doing.
Right. Yeah.
And so it really does look like it's going to be a bare bones year for us. And as Mary McKittrick has indicated, our city administrator, she considered it a good year coming up this next fiscal year if we can continue to provide quality services, our basic services, and maintain our staff. She would consider that a good year.
Maybe the school district will lend you some money.
Oh, yes.
There you go.
One additional project that seems about a quarter complete is the movable piece Kris Kringle House.
Yeah.
Are they going to have to complete the off-street parking right up against the church or all that? What was technically the project definition to move the house versus to build the new building? Because that, you know, it obviously has negative impact.
Well, it's another crash and burn. Don't use crash and burn. Another crash and burn scenario. The house was moved.
Mm-hmm. Boy, I didn't know she was still
there. We know
that. And the project didn't move forward. The parking lot that was to serve both Movable Feast and now the designer's something.
Designer's desk.
Didn't get built because it was tied to the Movable Feast project. So what the city did in order to achieve code compliance with respect to the Kris Kringle House, the designer's desk, that's all. A transformer had to be put in to provide power to designer's desk, and it's also sized to accommodate the Movable Feast building. There has been, I'm not going to get into it, but there have been dozens of conversations and interactions between city staff, city attorney, attorneys for designer's desk, attorneys for the other ownership entity, over all of this. Since the site plan for the Movable Feast project was approved, it was never built, and apparently they don't have the capacity to build it at this point. We still needed a drive to provide public utility access, truck access to the transformer. So the pavement that you see out there is a drive to service the transformer. About 3 weeks ago, the owners of Designer's Desk decided they were going to put some gravel down along the east side of their building, and now they're parking there. We had a staff meeting on this on Monday, and we will be requiring them to remove that gravel and remove the parking because it has not been approved. It has not been designed properly. There's no stormwater system associated with it. There's no curbing. There's no nothing. So that has to be removed. We'll probably have to put a chain or something across that drive if it's perceived as a parking lot. We would love, and it's been discussed on numerous occasions, we'd want to see a parking lot built there. But the owners, which is not the Designer's Desk owners, the other owners of the rest of that lot, have no interest in building a parking lot until they have a building and a user for that lot. So it is, it's a mess.
What's the city's coverage on that? Didn't we participate to a certain extent as far as the city's something vacating parking, street parking or something? I'm trying to remember the old layout now, because didn't we lose some parking on this diagonal parking on the street? Because didn't Natalie really exist there?
Yeah, at this point...
I don't think we lost anything.
Okay. We don't have a development. And it creates a situation where our leverage is very limited. I think we had LOC for the improvements involving the apron and the sidewalk and that.
So the Third Street developer, he's already passed his window as far as building his original plan. So he's going to have to come back in on his new building anyhow.
If they were going to come in with something at this point, they would have to start over.
So they have no incentive.
Is that Augustine?
It's an ownership group. Augustine is in there, and Jager is in there.
But Dick, was now the movement of the Kris Kringle House, was there any, you know, whether it was what type of building requirements were part of that? Whether it was landscaping, whether it was whatever kind of improvements, you would think there would have been something for them to have to finish. But there wasn't anything.
Because of our you know, Murphy's Law, really applying well here. This was intended to be one development, but it required a subdivision. They subdivided the property because the Designer's Desk owners, prospective owners, wanted their own lot and their own building on their lot. Well, in the process of moving that, we do have an accommodation in the lot division for spaces that are tied specifically to Designer's Desk. But just because of the geometry and the configuration of it, what we don't want to do is build that 3 or 4 space parking area, because it frustrates the design of the larger parking area that would be built in there with the second building. It's a very goofy situation. But
so the Designer's Desk owns their property and has a separate entity from...
And it's like a carved out piece, a small piece of that larger parking lot that you would build.
Yeah, it would work fine if both buildings would have been built.
Oh, it would have been seamless, and it would have been great if both would have been built.
What's going on with the old Provincial House? Well, the house is still up there. I know they moved. Is it going to be condemned?
There's a new owner that's purchased the property, and they're looking at rebuilding a portion of the back portion of the building.
Kind of have
to. It's been reviewed by HPC because of what's been going on there. I don't know the exact status of that one, but I just know that there's a new owner that's interested in making some changes.
I'm amazed, too.
This is such an upbeat meeting.
New Year. We're not going to be able to tell them put the parking in first to get the construction workers off of James or 3rd Street, so we're going to have to put up with the construction fencing and all that parking.
Well, I mean, we're going to have to cross that bridge, I guess, when we come to it.
It's a very upsetting situation that
somewhere.
Well, Happy New Year!
Yeah, it's a difficult time. I mean, I've been doing this work for 37 years now, and I have not seen it this challenging, this difficult. But it is a time to do some planning. If we're not building, we should be planning.
Well, and back to the downtown, Dick and I have had this discussion because I sat in on the interviewing of the consultants, and I've told Dick I think it should be a very high priority because I think once we do come out of this economic morass that we're in, it's going to be very important that we be able to hit the ground running with some viable plans for downtown. So, and I understand the economic problems too. I can't be critical of the city for pulling back. There's only so much money. I haven't even had my leaves picked up yet, so. That's
you don't have any political problems.
None.
I still haven't gotten my curb fixed.
I think you get to put them in a bag, but you don't have to put a sticker on it.
Yeah.
Now you've got to put a sticker on it. I think it's after.
After.
Well, if you'd like to come over and help me put them in a bag, you're welcome to do it.
I'll get back to you.
After the adventures of snow.
Anything else?
Move to adjourn.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Second.
Hit the gavel before you did that, Mim.
Nothing.
Essentially nothing in March. Oh.